This is Waris Hussein, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Yeah?
Gallifrey Public Radio, a weekly podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of Doctor Who. We travel through classic and new episodes, explore the extended universe, and play a few games from time to time. We do discuss news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor, but we'll warn you before anything considered spoilers comes up.
Welcome to episode 380 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've learned that we owe all our advancement in civilization and technology to a 400 million year lab test run by an evil, albeit rather suave, mad genius of a walking fern. I'm Jay.
I'm Kier.
And I'm Julie. This week we enjoy two Time Lords working hard to protect the human race, while the best representative of humanity chooses to hit things a lot. In City of Death, a holiday romp in Paris turns up a plot that stretches back to the primordial ooze. Talk about playing the long game.
We've been waiting for this one. Jay, I think when we started doing the classic rewatches, it was just a matter of how long is it going to take us?
Oh, yeah. No, this has always been the, like, let's get there. It's all going to fall apart after this one.
I mean, precisely, yeah. At this point, it's just, Davison. Davison who? but we'll get our initial reactions here. Jay, I know your familiarity with the story, but trying to be discerning about it, just on the surface, what is your general opinion of this odd little four-part story?
I love it. I think it's fantastic. It's a solid story that actually includes time travel. I would dare say that this is my favorite classic story.
All right. Julie, you're pretty familiar with this one as well, right?
I think they did a feature of it in one of those highlights where they picked the best of each Doctor.
Oh, right.
For the 50th anniversary?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, 50th anniversary. So we watched it, I think, a couple times then because it's your favorite too, maybe? So, yes. But my take and the reason why I love this episode is story is that it's one of the classic... There's a lot going on in history that doesn't change because of the story. The Doctor was always there, and that's why things went the way they went. And I love those stories.
Preserving the fixed point in time.
Correct. And they think that they are fixing things, the Doctor and his companions, or her companions, but they're really just keeping everything the way it's supposed to be by following through with their plans or their ideas. And those are my favorites, so this is a favorite.
Well, I have to agree on all points. This is one of the, if not the crown gem in the Tom Baker era, but potentially across Classic Who, maybe because of my personal tastes, my form of entertainment, even outside of Doctor Who, you know, as far as writers that I enjoy and just general stories where if you're going to put certain things into what you would call a sci-fi story or even a scientifically inclined comedic story, this hits a lot of those salient points. But let's dig a little deeper and see exactly why it is that this is the our favorite entree on the menu.
Yes.
Oh! I say. What a wonderful butler. He's so violent. Hello. I'm called the Doctor. That's Romana. That's Duggan. You must be the Countess Scaglione. And this is clearly a delightful Louis Cairns chair. May I sit in it? I say, haven't they worn well? Thank you, Hammond. That'll be all.
Doctor, you're being very pleasant with me.
Well, I'm a very pleasant fellow.
This story wasn't supposed to exist in the form that we know it. If you'll notice, the writing credits do not give the writing credits to Douglas Adams, even though we know that he was very much the hand at the pen, or potentially typewriter. I think it was a typewriter, as far as the story goes. But it's credited to David Agnew. This is the second time we've seen David Agnew used in right. Classic Who as getting a writer credit. So it's a pseudonym used in instances where, specifically within Doctor Who, because I know you end up, there are cases in other, in film and television where you have a particular name that gets made up when you have to give credit to, or when you're not giving credit to somebody specifically, you're hiding the actual individual behind it.
Nom de plume.
Exactly. Well, a nom de usage, if you will. But in this particular case, because you had the story editor and the producer actually doing the writing, well, that would be a big issue with the Writers Guild, and they would have come really crashing down on it. So they make up a name and say, oh, well, we have this gentleman, David Agnew, came in. The story, if you have the opportunity, go and get the DVD set, the Blu-ray sets that go along with these airs, and there's a featurette on there that's called Springtime in Paris, and it was done back in the mid-90s or so when the first DVD release was being put up. And it's a great little featurette because it involves some of the interviews with Graham Williams, with Douglas Adams, even with David Fisher. David Fisher was the writer. If you remember him, he wrote Stones of Blood and stories of that sort, ones that had a lot of action. Jay, you and I really love Stones of Blood because it had great supporting characters.
Right.
And the fact that it was as comedic as it could be without really getting in the way of the suspense and the danger. So that was kind of Fisher's forte, and they wanted to go with him again. Apparently, he was going through a rough patch, going through a divorce. He was working on a couple of other writing projects, couldn't get this one pulled together in time, and he had started a story that he was referring to as a gamble with time, where the bracelet was being used by this woman who wasn't necessarily the Countess, who was using it to fix the roulette wheel in a casino. Okay. And the BBC execs didn't really like the fact that it was leaning hard on gambling. So he had all these things working against it, and Fisher couldn't get the story ready nearly in time. So according to the director's recount, he said, if you remember those stories where you hear about writers staying up into the wee hours of the night, locking themselves away somewhere, drinking gallons of coffee, and wrapping wet towels around their heads to come up with the ideas, that's literally what happened, and I know it happened because I was the one brewing the coffee. Then it cuts to Douglas Adams, who said, yeah, we wrote this thing over the course of a weekend, under the gun, primarily mostly on a Saturday night, with regular intervals of whiskey and coffee.
So just like Duggan.
just like Duggan, yeah. That's probably where Duggan emerges. But as everybody gives note to, even though Graham Williams was there for some as a producer and as co-writer on this, sort of as a steering hand of what could or couldn't kind of rework, because they did have some of the bones from the original Gamble with Time story, but they had to rejigger it a bit to make it something where it still had Leonardo da Vinci was still in it. Mm-hmm. There was still a matter of Mona Lisa's being done, and da Vinci was cranking them out because he was trying to make the perfect one, and all these things. There were some aspects there that were absolutely the same, but they had to punch up the humor and punch up the dialogue, and of course that's when you hand it to Douglas Adams.
Right.
So, yeah, I love the evolution of this entire story and the fact that something that we all kind of love so much was generated in roughly 72 hours.
Hey, when you have that high school procrastination pushing you
straight. Oh my God, the book report. Oh, it's 4 a.m.
You don't have time to make it bad, so it has to be good.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Some of my greatest work came at like 5 a.m. the morning that stuff was due.
Yeah.
You would never have thought of it before that. It would never have turned out the way it was supposed to because the inspiration is somewhat forced and somewhat alcohol driven.
Exactly.
Then it gets there.
There have to be certain chemicals released in the brain, panic chemicals, fight or flight chemicals that trigger just amazing feats of creativity.
Yeah, when mixed with just the right amounts of caffeine and alcohol, that's where creativity is born right there.
I'm telling you. Elon Musk needs to drink more. Anyway, so discussing that idea of incorporating the humor and still maintaining a storyline that has some bite to it, I consider this particular story a little unusual in that aspect. Because if you were to lop off the fourth episode, I want to ask you both, do you really consider what Scaroth is doing to be that particularly dangerous? It may be a little evil, it may be a little nefarious, but it isn't until the fourth story that you realize that if he doesn't have this containment field, that it could take a huge area with him. Yeah. And then you realize the even greater risk that he's going to go back and change the spark of creation. That's not until well into the fourth episode. So it seemed like it seems like to me that through the first three, he's just a, you know, he's a ne'er-do-well. He's a bit of a crook. He's a shyster, a con man, a, you know, a thief.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of the extent of it.
Yeah, it's more just the, it feels more like they're stopping him. It's like, hey, you're messing around with time, which humans aren't supposed to do for a long time yet. Mm-hmm. Like, let's stop you because you don't know the danger that you're getting into right now. So,
right.
But yeah, it's not like earth-shattering kind of, you know, world-ending danger. It's just, hey, you're messing with something you're not supposed to.
Yeah.
Right. And for the purpose of we don't know until the fourth episode as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's almost like the ante keeps getting raised.
Mm-hmm.
So exactly. It's just, you know, there's a certain level of danger and they're obviously trying to figure it out throughout.
Mm-hmm.
But then it does, and I think you get those moments, especially for Scaroth himself, where he falls to the floor and then you realize something way bigger is going on than we realize, than he realizes.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that it was a very solid story, and then the heat got turned on for that last episode.
Right, right. But you don't even notice, I mean, if you call that turning up the heat in the fourth episode where you realize that there's much larger stakes and everyone is now really aware of it. But even then, through the first three, you call that the simmer, if you to extend the analogy. But even then, everything that you're working with is so engaging and so entertaining. And the characters from top to bottom of the cast list are pouring so much into it, with the exception of maybe the voiceless thugs. You still gotta love the voiceless thugs.
They serve a purpose.
They do.
Have a role.
Very taciturn. Yes. Very taciturn.
I also found at some points the Countess kind of threw me off a bit.
How so?
I just felt that she maybe stumbled on her lines, where I didn't feel that she, as the strong, independent woman of his, would, like, her turning and always having the smoke was kind of delayed, and but not suave. So I was watching her contrast to the professor. I mean, like,
to the Count.
To the Count was very.
Like, we'll get to the professor in a minute.
I'm kind of picking up on what you're saying, Julie. She did seem slightly out of place compared to everyone else, but I think that part of what that was is, like, everyone in the cast, every single one of them, came with their eating utensils. They went to town on the scenery. Everyone was larger than life. Everyone was, you know, it was aiming for the stars when they were acting. And she was more subdued, more kind of realistic, like, this is how a normal person would react in this kind of situation or something like that. So she didn't seem to fit with everyone else, even though arguably it was the more realistic portrayal.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I agree with you on that, because her being too real made everyone else feel over the top, but they were all committed and everyone, so she was trying to be the straight man.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't need a straight man.
Right.
I always accepted it in my head because of the fact that knowing what you realize about her character by the time the story closes is that she's been trying to live this life. She's been not riding on coattails, but wanting to be the partner in crime that she's not necessarily prepared for, because she didn't want the stakes or the collateral damage from this life of nefarious deeds and does that they did. She didn't want them to have any real harm involved.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment that she starts to cotton on to the fact that there are more people getting harmed or more danger or more risk involved with this than just them, snatching a few items and pulling off some great capers and heists, then it starts to wobble a bit. And that's how my head just said that, yeah, she doesn't seem to fit because she's not supposed to fit.
Okay. I also accept that, yeah. She thought that he was one human. And also that, right, they were stealing things for the purpose of just the resale or the adventure of it. Mm-hmm. And it never was about that for him from ooze through time.
Yeah. Keeping her in brandy and cigarette holders for life. There is a recipe of elements in here that I think, as we touched on in the intro, that are, in my book, what I think makes the greatest dish of a Classic Who episode. Has to have time travel. You know, you can't just have something where they just walk into the room and the adventure starts, right? There has to be some reason why. And even with this one where it just, they're taking a vacation in Paris, but they're tinkering around with the fact that, you know, oh, Paris is like a, it's like a bouquet. It's a bouquet. Where? It's 1979. It's a bit more of a table wine.
Yeah.
So they're toying with the time travel a little bit. But then you also get the idea of having Skaroth scattered or broken across history. They didn't get to use as much of that as they wanted to. Apparently in the original Gamble with Time story, there was much more involvement from the other pieces.
Mm-hmm. I want that.
Right. Yeah. That would have been cool. If this were, this might have been, I'll pull the break here for a second. You know how we're always talking about we want to take some of the Classic Who stories that run long and trim an episode?
Yeah.
Would this have the room?
To have been six? Yes,
or at
please.
Least five.
No, six.
Duggan's return.
One half of the fifth episode would be, yes, Duggan, how he became here. And then the, you know, what, 12 shades of Skaroth? Nine or 12?
12 fragments.
Yeah, 12. So I could see that kind of mixing in and just taking, it'd be one of those little intermission ones where you follow the two of them and then come back to the story.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a Family Guy or any of those shows where they drop a quick mention of something that's happened in the past, and rather than just letting it be a mention, they cut away and actually give you that scene just for Haas.
Yes, please.
Why is Duggan there, you know? It's just,
So that they can break out of doors at convenient moments and through walls?
Smash walls.
Seriously,
Duggan. I've loosened all the mortar. I mean, he is... I'm gonna cross streams here. He is Ram Man from the He-Man show.
But he is so dedicated to being that person that it works.
Exactly.
Every single thing he touches is a boom, boom, boom.
Yes.
He can't even open a bottle of wine.
He's breaking the glass just to get into the... Like, the door could be unlocked, and he still breaks the glass to get in.
Precisely.
Yes.
Yes. That he will dismantle desks to get the letter opener.
And not only does he break the bottle of wine to pour it, he also then drinks out of the broken bottle. No glass, just...
Yep. Because that's Duggan.
It's Duggan.
I need more Duggan stories. You know, with everything they do, with Big Finish or these lockdown add-on little sequels they do, I want Duggan's log or just, you know, I want a film noir where he's sitting in some smoky Parisian cafe, the cigarette smoke swirling around his balding head.
No,
Paris, 1979. Didn't know why I'm here.
I would love to see like something where the doctor in any future iteration, you know, 10, 12, 13, whichever one, I don't care. One of them just has something ridiculous, like a jar that they can't open. So they go on this whole quest to hunt down Duggan.
You just see it land, hands it out the door, comes back, glass broken.
Exactly.
But it's open and we can get into it.
In case of emergency, call Duggan.
Yeah. I want Where in the World is Duggan, like Carmen Sandiego, and just track him going to all of these random, it's not necessarily even always an art issue. It's just a random task that whatever police force he's on says, go there, figure out what's going on.
You don't even need, you could do this as a slideshow. You don't even need the actor or someone portraying him at that mm-hmm. point to do that. You just need to cut from scene to scene of some police precinct and someone looking up and saying, who broke the damn water cooler? Or, and then it cuts to somebody else like, this freaking stapler's all janky. What happened to this thing?
But he's useful, though. It's not always yeah. just breaking it for the sake of.
Yeah.
You know,
no, he always has a point to break things.
Right. Yeah. And so they've been trying to get through these stones, and then it's, well, I'm always ready, or my machine's always charged, whatever he says.
I'm always angry, Captain.
I'm always exactly. angry. And I think I mentioned this as I was watching through it, kind of. They're just chatting, the doctor and Romana, and then all of a sudden, they're like, oh, while we've been talking, you could have been breaking this door down. Why don't you do it now? Just...
Well, yeah, it's like the conversation, Doug has been in there for a day. They get locked back in there again. They have this conversation. They turn to Doug and say, Duggan, do it.
Had he picked up on the subtle, not so subtle, we should be getting out of here vibe as the conversation flowed.
I love him.
It would have, you know, those moments, though.
Just a force of nature, a blunt object. That's all he is. I think the only character that I kept having a little bit of an issue with, and I'll never be completely resolved with it just because I don't think he had completely found quite where he wanted to be, was the professor. It was just, it just wasn't quite on the same level as everybody else that he was working with. And it was at its, I get it. He was, his caricature was what it needed to be in 99% of the instances. But his death scene.
Yeah.
Was but so bad.
That's always the sticking point for me too.
But the slow herky-jerking under the lasers, they could have just asked him to fall back out of frame, and I think it would have worked just as nicely. But, you know, you get a couple of takes. You're doing this on film.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have a need-noggle to show him what it should look like.
No, exactly. Everybody's got to have a need-noggle.
Yeah.
Effects-wise, though, that actually brings up an interesting point. They're rather subtle.
Mm-hmm.
This is something where you could have gone really over the top with trying to get laser beams firing all over the place and just instead of just doing a couple of overlays for like the aging and regressing chicken mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, the opening sequence with the Jaggeroth ship
mm-hmm.
that actually looked pretty good.
It did look good. When they're breaking in to steal the Mona Lisa with the beams, when they appear and then how they move and shift back was very interesting and subtle, and also brought in the cast to be part of it because it came from the Count. It was him sort of sharing the story. That kind of thing was very interesting.
Because hologram usage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yes. That's what happens when you get Douglas Adams writing for you. You start getting bleeding edge technology in 1979. I think all around, there are a lot of things that Whovians of various familiarity levels could touch upon and say, all right, that's an element of a Who episode that I really enjoy. So I'm going to enjoy it for the fact that it's got this kind of dark humor. Or I'm going to get into this one because it requires him going back in time and setting something up, you know, marking mm-hmm. the fakes and that kind of stuff. There is the heist aspect of it. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of the, you know, figuring out the idea of having to, as you were saying, like breaking through lasers, getting into the Louvre and using technology. Well, we think the bracelet is there to actually monitor all the cameras and security systems, but we find it's also there to keep the Countess mm-hmm. in check.
Yeah.
So double bad on you.
But I also love the fact that up to that point, we get this whole thing of like, oh, the Doctor and Romana are there to, or, you know, they're working with Duggan to help stop the heist. Through the whole thing is just like, no, we've got to stop the Mona Lisa from being stolen. And this, that, and the other. And then they completely fail at it. Like, they're like, okay, we're ready to go. What do you mean it's already done? Like, it's the whole crux that we thought we were going towards, they completely fail at. And that reveals the larger scheme behind it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's that great moment of like, oh, they're going to save the day and they're going to, what do you mean they didn't stop it?
Right. Which seems a little unusual. I mean, we always talk about the when we do these classic rewatches, the fact that in a lot of times the story, the plot seems split, right? Mm-hmm. You're pursuing one path, and then all of a sudden the curtain behind you drops and you realize you're part of a much larger scheme, right? And the stakes are suddenly amped to 11 and so on. Or the baddie that you've been tracking along all along is just a henchman compared to the big bad that you didn't see earlier. But that sort of pullback, the idea that that they failed, mm-hmm. is really unusual. I don't know if we've actually come up against that to date, as far as whatever their prime directive was on, all right, here's what we've got to do. Here's the adversaries as far as we know it. Oh, wait, we what? Oh, well, I meant to do that because there's a bigger bad to deal with. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've seen that before.
It also plays into the fact that they split and have two different tasks as well. And technically, so the Doctor accomplishes a mission, which is very different from what he set out to do when he went back to talk to Leonardo as well. Mm. It turned out well, and we think that that will become what happened. But he technically, when he left, he just left a note.
Yeah.
He didn't actually talk to him. Yes, the intricate detail of riding backwards and putting the mirror, which is a... If you don't know Leonardo, then maybe it wouldn't make sense to you, but anybody who's studied a little art history would. Mm-hmm. But there's no confirmation that that's how it went down. He could have still painted on different panels, or Sagaroth being there could have seen it. We don't think he did, and obviously the story wouldn't play out as well as it could have done, but any of those steps could have been incorrect. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's very interesting. It not humanizes and makes them lesser, but it sort of makes them not infallible.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is interesting, even knowing that you're dealing with two of the most intelligent Time Lords ever to come out of the Citadel, can still make some not judgment errors necessarily, but missteps.
Yeah, they made some assumptions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what would you consider to be your favorite moments in this? What are the aspects of the story that really are the ones that say, you know, the first thing I think of, when I think about City of Death, my mind immediately goes to XYZ.
I kind of have to go with Duggan. I mean, just everything Duggan is in, he is irremovable from this story for me. Like, City of Death and Duggan go hand in hand. But also
City of Duggan.
I mean, all of the characters, Donald Glover, you know, Duggan, everything in here is fantastic. But I think the thing that kind of sticks out to me the most when I think about it is that this seems quintessential Fourth Doctor to me. Like, this is Baker firing on all cylinders with somebody who wrote for him that understood his doctor. You know, the fantastic chemistry between him and Romana. Like, this is perfect. This is the perfect episode to show someone to completely encapsulate what the Fourth Doctor is. You know, from his snarky lines about, you know, it's like, oh, what a wonderful butler. He's so violent. You know, and the little lines that he gets like that, to just the over-the-top goofball antics that, you know, that he gets into. That's what sticks in my mind about this story.
I personally have to say that it's the location shoots. Mm-hmm. That even though they're not necessarily that intrinsic to the story, something about the fact that when I see those scenes, when I see them trying to cross a busy street, near the Arc de Triomphe or something of that sort, or Duggan running to catch up with them with his tie tucked in his pants, and you know, again, back to Duggan, but I have to wonder to a certain degree how much of this, when those things were shot, like, did they actually cordon off the street? Were those extras? Did they just say, you know what, by the time we get these couple of scenes shot, no one's going to realize that that's Tom Baker in Paris. We're just going to get these things done. Because the camera is like behind a wrought iron fence in the middle of a park shooting them. I loved how reachable that was.
Yeah, I get the sense that it really wasn't. They're like, all right, we're here. Like, we're just going to set the camera up here. You guys run down the street towards it, and then we'll move on. And there was no... You also have to wonder, like, if... In the how prevalent was Doctor Who in France in the 70s? Like, is that something that they really paid attention to, or is that, you know, some kitschy little British show that maybe one or two people might have heard of, but
and like, remember, no social media, so yeah. If someone saw them, what were they going to do? Go into a shop and call and say, "Ma, come look, they're out there."
Yeah. Maintenant.
Or right, I don't know French, but you get the idea.
Maman, le docteur est ici.
My favorite moments are pretty consistent, and it's the writing. And it's the moments where someone will say something and either the doctor or Romana take it the opposite of what is meant. And then you just get the chuckle of when they sort of correct the whoever had said it. I don't have one on the top of mind, so I can't say exactly. But every one of those moments where, you know, because it happened between the Countess and the doctor, and it happened between Duggan and Romana when they're in the cafe waiting for the doctor, and they'll say something and they sort of take it like, "Oh, you mean this? Oh, no, I meant this. Oh, right. Yep. Chuckle, chuckle." Every one of those, it's not a guffaw, but it's definitely a chuckle. Oh, yeah. I laugh.
I think, that ties together exactly what you're saying with what Jay was saying. It's a matter of, in with regards to the writing, the script was interesting and entertaining enough that then the cast riffs on that, and it's really written for them rather than something that's written and they just carry it out, they execute. This has far more to do with their voices. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I get it. Is there anything about this particular story? It's not like I'm not trying to, you know, to poop on the picnic table or anything here, but is there anything about this story that you would want to change?
I want more.
Okay, other than the brevity.
Yeah. I don't like the reveal. I see where they were going for with it, but I don't like the reveal of the Egyptian scroll.
Really?
Moment. Okay. I think that had she ever seen that, she would have known something was weird. And I think that the moment where they sort of, and maybe I misinterpreted it, but I feel like it was a moment where she remembers, like, "Oh, I've seen this before." And for her to go to that and then, like, that's the moment where the walls come crashing down. Mm-hmm. Maybe if it were in a picture book or some other something, but like the one scroll tucked in this one area, like she's read all of those and didn't recognize that as something seriously weird.
Well, then, I mean,
I don't know.
That one I kind of write off because it's just, again, it's the 70s. How many people were really that well versed in hieroglyphics? And it, you know, maybe it's something that they had, you know, acquired at some point or whatever, and like she had seen it before, but then the doctor saying, you know, this is what he looks like, her being like, that sounds vaguely familiar, you know, it's not something that would have triggered before because it's Egyptian paintings on a scroll, and
right,
so
but that, also, why does it exist too, like that, just the whole thing, in no other instance has he shown anyone who he is and what he really looks like,
right?
True.
Did he write himself onto it?
In that segment of him as Scarlione or Scarother, however you want to describe him, was fragmented. The decisions of the other segments are entirely their own. They're in some sort of weird mental connection, but maybe the one that was in, you know, 4000 BC in Egypt or Sumeria or what have you, felt that the only way to accomplish what he needed to move civilization forward, because that was their collective goal, was to appear as some sort of a god. So on that scroll, you've got like Anubis, and you've got a being with a jackal's head and a being with another head. So that kind of thing is all, that's all there. So that didn't, maybe the first time she saw it, she thought, "Oh, I've never seen this green-headed thing before," and she just kind of files it away mentally.
Okay.
But the fact that as soon as the doctor describes, green skin, eye in the center of the forehead, the penny drops. Mm-hmm. And she knows, she's like, that's that weird thing that I saw in that scroll 6 months ago when we stole it from Giza or what have you.
Fair. So, all right. Accepted. I don't have anything else I would change.
More Duggan.
I would add two episodes, and one would be Duggan, and one would be the other Scaroth.
versions. Yeah, and getting the other fragments of Skyroth. Yeah, even just tangentially, because you see, I'm trying to think what other faces you saw in that moment where they had all the overlay, and you had one that looked like it was maybe wearing kind of an a medieval helmet.
Mm-hmm. You had Caesar. You had a Roman one.
Right. One wearing the olive branches. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of things to play with.
Greek or Roman. Mm, mm-hmm. I bet there was one on Atlantis.
Sure, because why not?
I mean, basically we're saying that most major rises in technology were because of this.
Right.
Mm-hmm. 12 main points through history. Well, 11 previous points through history.
Well, mm-hmm. there's our tie-in, is who's to say that Scarleone was the furthest into the modern realm? Like, let's have a new Doctor Who episode where, oh, hey, look, we came across the 12th one in 2020.
Well, no, because at that point, at that 12th piece, 12th facet, he had the crude enough technology to do what he needed to do. Granted, mm-hmm. Romana gave him, you know, pushed him across the goal line there. But yeah, I think at that point he said, all right, 1979, mm-hmm. I got all the rough tools. I can work with this pile of mud and sticks and get what I need back to.
No, that's what we do. Is like the one in the current days has actually been diagnosed as like schizophrenic or something, and so he's heavily medicated and wasn't able to contribute.
He was the one that got cast way too far forward. I'm not contributing to the goal.
I have a question. Hmm? Where did he acquire a Sonic knife?
I think the whole premise of Sonic anything was just so entertaining they couldn't let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it seems almost perfunctory at this point, but rewatchability and recommendability. Do we even need to go around the horn on this one?
I mean, I'm willing to speak for all three of us and say yes and yes.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is one that I easily throw in front of someone that has never seen a classic episode. And I'm like, just get past the fact that it was made in the 70s and the production value might be a little bit under what you expect, but just pay attention to the story, pay attention to the characters, and it's almost every time, you know, it knocks it out of the park.
Very true. I've handed this to more people than I can recall. Mm-hmm. And it always seems to tick-lick as far as, even if they, I think to a certain degree, if you just tell them, all right, this is 1979, mm-hmm. This is the Doctor at that time. This is their companion at the time. So you understand the premise. So here are your players.
Right.
And, you know, total running time, if you were to take out the bit of overlaps, that, you know, the couple of minutes mm-hmm. Leading into each one as the cliffhanger from the previous, your total runtime start to finish is like barely 80 minutes. So it's like a good, long, modern episode if you were to stitch it all together. And it flows really nicely.
I mean, there's a lot of times where I'll try and break up the classic episodes that we watch, and I'll watch one day and one, so I don't get, you know, lost in or whatever. And this one I had, you know, because you hit the third episode and it's just like, okay, I'm going to go make myself a sandwich and just let it play because they're just running down another corridor. But this one, I have no problem with sitting through the entirety of it every time.
Yeah. Yeah. So there you have it. Plus, and again, I mentioned this back at the beginning of the conversation. If you have the opportunity to be able to get one of the releases that has the additional footage, there's not only that Springtime in Paris, which is the little featurette that they put together on the creation of it, but there's actually something else that is, it's called like W12, that is a blooper reel.
Okay.
Bloopers and outtakes. A lot of them are things like, you know, you have the actor standing there and they said they get halfway through a scene and they stop and they're like, no, there's a shadow across your face. We got to get lighting back in here. Or they go up on a line, or the countess keeps saying, my cigarette's too long. Because they keep having to go back to cuts and she's like, that's supposed to be shorter, it's long. But just having that, there's very few instances that I know of in from the classic Who, of any Doctor's era, where you get to see a lot of that extra footage. Mm-hmm. There are some deleted scenes, but this is a whole chunk of like 10 solid minutes of all of these little flubs or things like that. And it's a ton of fun. It's just more goodies. So yeah, something to look out for. tried to put these news items in some sort of order that made sense in my head, but then I forgot what sense that was. So I'm going to hope it comes back to me over the course of rolling these out. So remember how we started talking about this Time Lord Victorious project, initiative, endeavor that they're working on that's going to involve books and comics and audio and,
right,
and some digital footage. Well, we got our first chunk on the way in the form of a couple of books being published by BBC Books directly.
Say that again 10 times fast.
I can't. I can't even say it 2 times fast. But they are going to start to feed into this Time Lord Victorious storyline. I'm a little bit confused because if you take them on the synopses, while they both involve the 10th Doctor, they don't seem at the moment to have anything to do with the overarching premise behind the Victorious storyline, where it has to be where it's like at the cradle of time.
Well, I thought that from the synopsis, it sounded like the Big Bad is introduced in this.
In the first of the two?
In the first of the two, and then the second of the two is a little bit of the... They've done something at the end of the first, so the second picks that up and is where the additional Doctor characters get added in the mix and have taken on roles already that 10th comes into.
So we're going to get to see the interweaving. So maybe if the first story is just that teeing up who the potential adversary is. I say potential. I'm not really sure.
They were calling themselves, for lack of a better way, but the way that we kind of describe it, as they were deciding as God how long each race lives.
Mm.
And prior to that, Cradle of Time, there were no death. Like, death was not a thing that anyone knew or feared.
Right.
So
right.
This is creating time as a, it has a stop. So then you fear the end of it.
Right. Because they were, I know when they were describing the premise behind this entire project, that they were saying that this even predated the Eternals.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of things that could be moved forward here. Realizing the scope of what they're attempting to do, I do like the fact that they're using a couple of novels to get this started, because that way, if by the, as you say, by the close of the second book, if the camera kind of pulls back a bit, so to speak, and you realize that the other Doctors have been dealing with related facets that they don't yet realize are part of a larger puzzle, then that allows the spiderweb effect, mm-hmm, to splinter outward. And you can have, from that point, all of these tangential stories that work encapsulated. I just saw this little digital film, or I just read this book, or I just played this game, or what have you. But if you choose to start to weave them together, you get this fuller thing. I think it's really, really ambitious.
Yeah, you can sort of jump into it wherever you like and then go back or go forward, because now you know a little bit about it.
Kind of works the way we've been watching Doctor Who all along, because especially with Big Finish, one of their premises is they say, we find gaps in the original storyline,
mm-hmm,
and throw an adventure in there.
So that whole big gap where Paul McGann just kind of like hangs out?
Yep.
Makes sense.
And it's perfect.
It's lovely.
We've been enjoying a lot of the scheduled rewatches that have been happening on a global scale. I am really glad that they've announced this next one. There are a bunch of them that are currently in flux. But this latest one that caught my attention, I think, is interesting on a lot of regards. Not just because this is one of the few instances where Jay really appreciates the work of Mark Gatiss.
One of the few,
yeah. He makes a nice Brigadier Daddy, too. But we're going to have another go-around of getting more insight into the work of the biopic Adventure in Space and Time, with some really interesting guests to sort of tweet along and share some additional insight on it, poignant on a number of levels. So we get Mark Gatiss, but we also get Sacha Dhawan. So, who many people, if you didn't get a chance to see this before, you may not have realized, that he actually played our first director. So which is how, you know, he got introduced to the entire Whovian family. I'm eager with a lot of these. I miss them because they're being broadcast for general consumption in the UK, which is absolutely understandable.
Right.
But it's the middle of the workday here stateside, so I may not be able to devote the time to follow the tweet stream on this. Mm-hmm. But going back and getting the immediate reaction articles and things that take these apart and say, oh, fascinating new information revealed, you know, blah 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 blah.
Right.
I'm expecting a lot of great stuff from this as well.
Well, and honestly, even watching it live and trying to keep up with the Twitter stream is a fool's errand. Like, you might catch a fraction of what's actually being said in the moment, and then after it's over, you scroll back to find all the stuff that you've missed.
Sure.
So it's one of those things that you're not really missing much by not being there live. So, you know, if there's an episode that you haven't watched that, you know, one of your favorites that you didn't get to take part in, go back and read the Twitter stream. Watch it on your own. Scroll through the Twitter feed at your leisure, because they do a great job of having individual hashtags for each one. So you can absolutely find what's going, you know, what was said about that particular episode. And it's fantastic, even if you're not able to be there watching it live.
Yeah. If you really want to hook up to the fire hose and you're really thirsty, you go ahead and follow the hashtag. Otherwise, just find the key players, you know, follow Sasha's and Mark's accounts. And just during that time period, go grab that timestamp and just say, all right, I'm just going to hear what they have to add into the conversation there. What you can grab at your leisure and enjoy to the fullest are the entire library of Series 12 scripts.
Yes.
Which is super cool. I've always relied on, there's a couple of key websites out there that will transcribe the scripts after the fact, usually in the days or week after it has aired. And it might start from using the closed captions and then starts, you know, filling it in from there with some stage direction and such.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the working scripts.
Mm-hmm. It will be very fun to see how they structure it and what notes are given. That kind of just how it's laid out will be very cool to see.
I can't wait to read Prisoner of the Jadoon. I want to know how much was in the stage directions for Ruth. Anyway.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
Speaking of scripts, so Peter Harness, we've had an opportunity to be able to get a couple some interesting insights. He's very forthcoming with information, and he's had a lot of opportunities to be able to work on recognized, finished, in the can, produced, released material for Doctor Who. Apparently, had some ideas for some other things that I personally, one of these two, I would have lost it. If had they made this decision,
can I guess which one?
It's pretty much a given.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's the monk, right?
Oh my gosh! Okay, good.
Yeah, because I love the meddling monk.
Who doesn't love the meddling monk? So yeah. Apparently, there had been. Steer with me on this. So we've got these. As he was describing being involved with the. This emerged from the tweet along, right? Mm-hmm. From the Zygon invasion inversion.
Yes.
So during that, among all the other, you know, we're talking about all the extra information that gets shared when these celebrities and creators give their insight during these broadcasts, he shared the fact that he had some ideas to bring to the table to BBC drama, that he wanted to bring some classic villains back. And one was the Mara, which is a really interesting call, but I can absolutely understand why that's a personal pleasure,
right?
And it may not be something that you could necessarily really. It's not like the Zarbi. Like, give me some giant ant people or something that could really work well on screen.
Don't badmouth the Zarbi.
I'd not. I'm saying that would have been a slam dunk. Note for the next time.
He can borrow it if he wants.
Feel free. You can take that one for free, Peter. But the other was the meddling monk, which. It rankles me that no one has given the green light to bring the monk back even in so much as a really good name check.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just wonder if the setup time that you would need for a Time Lord that's not the same as the Doctor or the Master would, one, confuse the people who aren't super invested. Hmm. And again, so the setup time to sort of bring them into the fold and then also create whatever crazy thing this guy... Because his plans are always... like, very intricate, I feel like.
Like Scarleone.
Well, yes.
And I would say, you know, it was...
It, you he did, was it did. Fair.
Evil for his own purposes, so it really wasn't a matter of... he wasn't murderous. He didn't really wish anybody harm. He was out for personal gain.
And willing to sacrifice everyone ever.
Well...
Everyone of the human race, anyways.
Yeah.
But... I don't know. I would also love to see it, so I won't poo-poo it.
It's got to be so difficult now, though, because we're in such a state of, I don't know what's really going on with the state of Gallifrey, with the state of the Time Lords, and so mm-hmm. on. Everything's been, you know, the entire puzzle box has been dumped over on the table and trampled.
I mean, but at this point, I think we've all gotten to the point where, you know, it's a normal question to ask, are the Time Lords actually a thing this week, or have they been destroyed again?
Right. Right.
We trust them? Do we not?
Right. Like, are they evil? Are they the good guys? Do they exist?
But one escape after Order 66. One Jedi. Still, yeah.
I'm the last of the Time Lords. Except for the Master, who keeps just showing up every time I take a breather. Yeah, I don't know.
The last of the Time Lords that matter. You know.
The last of the Daleks that... Oh, wait. There's 100 of them coming out of that one.
They were in a time bubble. Doesn't count. They were stuck in the elevator between floors. They couldn't... they couldn't elevate. All right. I left this last not because I had any sort of a big segue or tee up, although we did just mention Peter Harness discussing some of his backstory during the Zygon invasion and inversion tweet-alongs. Mm-hmm. Ingrid Oliver also was part of that that commentary, so to speak, that tweet-and-tweet-and-terry. Mm-hmm. Comment-tweeting?
Comment-tweeting.
Comment-tweety. It's comment-tweety. Just made that up right now. Hashtag that sucker.
You can also borrow that one for free, everyone.
Yep. No,
please take it here first.
Yeah, we're giving it away for free. So she also helped put together a little vignette to go along with this, that is probably the best use of one of these, the most timely use mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. one of these yet. So take me through how this worked.
So basically it's a Zoom call between friends, just checking up on each other, you know, something that we've all done countless times by now. Mm-hmm. You know, just say, hey, how are you holding up? You know, how are you filling your time kind of thing? And it's just, you know, Osgood and Osgood talking about life in lockup.
And just, they think they're on their own, giving everything away, and then not. So won't push it any further.
Don't spoil it. Yeah. With all these, there's always a little fun twist to it.
But just know, when you're on a Zoom call, it's kind of nice to pay attention to the person that you're with.
Precisely, right. And there are little Easter eggs in this, too.
The whole thing.
Like the icons on the desktop.
Yes.
Or the T-shirt.
Both.
Yeah, well, both. Yes. Yes, that's right. For different reasons.
Yes.
For very different reasons. It's just, it is so clever and it is so well put together. This may be my favorite one so far.
Agreed.
Yeah.
So.
Definitely go check it out.
And it's still a marketing piece.
It is still. Yes, it is still moving product.
Right.
Well done.
Yeah.
By BBC.
So good.
Worth it.
I'm Andrew from the Dad.io podcast. Life supplies the inputs and we supply the outputs. Part of the Going to Geek network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other fantastic and amazing geeky shows at goingtogeeknetwork.com.
Next week, we're going to be coming back with our Torchwood rewatch, End of Days. So the series finale of season one.
Yeah, we finally get to figure out what that creepy little curator was all about during Captain Jack Harkness and why he loves his Polaroid camera quite so much. This is, again, as we mentioned last week, we forgot that this was, last time we did, when we did Captain Jack Harkness, that episode a few weeks ago, we had forgotten that this was a two-parter.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Hey!
Yeah!
Yeah, this is part two.
Okay.
So, and I think it is a strong build to proving that Torchwood, by the close of its first season, really understood what it could do, how to do it, and how to make it feel like proper Doctor Who, as far as suspense and build and story arc and those things, while being darker and gorier and sexier and, you know,
smoldery.
All the things.
Smoldery. Smoky eyes.
Smoky eyes.
And dropping some F-bombs every once in a while, because we all do. Except on this
cast. It happens.
They finally figured out their makeup palette.
Oh, yeah.
They
did. But yeah, so that'll be our wrap-up for next week. So looking forward to seeing that. And we're going to continue. I think we're going to keep Torchwood Rewatch. We're not just going to pick up the needle and say, well, that was a good first season. We will, from that point on, go into season two and really take it when the Pistons are really firing, and season two is really one of the strong points on this one, which we still don't remember.
No,
we don't. We think we do, and then we see the episode, and then we go, "Oh yeah, it was that one."
I forgot that,
because we keep getting blinded by season three. But that's
I was gonna say
we'll get there.
I don't want
because your eyes are wet for hours.
Well, yes, leaking.
Oh, all right. Well, this has been episode 380 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, now I'm curious, what was the second most important punch in history?
And this is Kira saying, you will remember that this is what Kira is saying, because I wrote it in felt tip.
And this is Julie saying, who's built for this?
We'll see you guys next week.
And I'll see.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Want to keep the conversation going? You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Or just send us a good old-fashioned email to feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also give us a phone call at 754-225-5477. That's 754-CALL-GPR, and you may hear your voice on a future episode of the show. Everything's got to end sometime, otherwise nothing would ever get started. Join us next week for a brand new episode.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2020. See you next week.